This is an ABC podcast. Hello, welcome to The Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. On Tuesday, the High Court of Australia handed down a momentous decision. After 400 days behind bars, Cardinal George Pell was released from Barwon Prison. It followed a unanimous decision by the seven judges of the High Court of Australia, quashing his convictions for historic child sex offences. Here's part of a statement George Pell released today. Quote, "I have consistently maintained my innocence while suffering from a serious injustice. This has been remedied today with the High Court's unanimous decision. I hold no ill will toward my accuser. I do not want my acquittal to add to the hurt and bitterness so many feel. There is certainly hurt and bitterness enough. However, my trial was not a referendum on the Catholic Church, nor a referendum on how church authorities in Australia dealt with the crime of paedophilia in the church. The point was whether I had committed these awful crimes, and I did not. The only basis for long-term healing is truth, and the only basis for justice is truth, because justice means truth for all." End of quote. And at the end of the statement goes on to thank his supporters. Now, to analyse the High Court of Australia's decision, I'm joined by Professor Jeremy Gans, a criminal law expert at the University of Melbourne, David Maher, a journalist with The Guardian, and Justin Hanbury QC, a Melbourne barrister who often appears in sex assault and historical child sex abuse trials. Welcome to you all. In a sentence, I'd like to get a quick roundtable view from each of you about what principle lies at the heart of this momentous decision. What does this High Court decision tell us about our justice system? Jeremy Gans, if I can start with you.
Well, George Pell is wrong. Justice isn't truth, it's proof. And the High Court's ruling was that there wasn't proof of his guilt.
David Maher?
This is a judgment about doubt and about the power of doubt in the criminal process. All the way up to the High Court, everybody had to deal with doubts, and they had dealt with them in a way that supported the allegations against Pell and supported the man who had brought these complaints to the law. And in the High Court, the doubt swung absolutely the other way.
Justin Hanbury, QC.
I think this is an extremely culturally significant moment. I think it's the highest profile criminal case we've had, certainly in Melbourne, for a very, very long time. But ultimately, the decision is one that turns very much on its own facts and in a legal sense. I'm not sure how great the ramifications for other cases will be.
Okay, so it's all about reasonable doubt and what that is. Now, Jeremy Gans, if I can start with you, can you just remind listeners of the nature of the charges that were brought against George Pell? And we're going to talk a little bit about setting up what the facts and what the allegations were, how the trial proceeded and what the Court of Appeal decided before we get to what the High Court decided. So, Jeremy Gans, just remind listeners about the nature of the charges that were brought against George Pell.
So this is a historical child sexual abuse prosecution, and it differs a little from other similar prosecutions because this wasn't an allegation of abuse within a family home or even a private institution, a boarding house or the like. The allegation was that the abuse happened in a public or fairly public building, which was busy on one of its busiest days right after Mass.
And so basically, Cardinal George Pell was charged with sexual abuse of two choir boys in the priest sacristy at Melbourne St Patrick's Cathedral after a Mass in I think, late 1996. So what was the evidence that was heard at this trial, David Maher?
The only evidence supporting the allegation came from the man making the complaint against Pell. And the small elements of corroboration which the Court of Appeal in Victoria had made something of, his knowledge of the room, the fact that Pell was unusually in that room instead of another room on this particular occasion, the High Court completely swept away. That was the appeal. That was the evidence of the complainant, and against him.
And I should point out that, there were two alleged victims, but there was one complainant. The other alleged victim had died of a drug overdose some years ago, and had never come forward to police nor told anyone about these events. But the complainant who gave this evidence spoke to what he witnessed with respect to the other boy. And now there were 23 other witnesses. David Mark, please continue.
These were the witnesses which Pell's defence had gathered, and they were witnesses of the master of ceremonies at the time, Monsignor Portelli, of organists and sacristans and other church officials, and also of some former choir boys. And these witnesses gave evidence about the routines of the cathedral and where Pell would have been at any particular time. And in particular, the evidence of Monsignor Portelli, who was the master of ceremonies at the cathedral, was that he was standing with Pell on the steps outside the great west door of the cathedral, farewelling worshippers, at the time the crimes were supposed to have been committed, and later was always with Pell as he was wearing his robes and returned to the room where he removed his robes. Now, at the trial and at the appeal, that evidence was looked at, and a sort of way was found through it in order to give superior weight to the evidence of the complainant, because everybody, apart from Pell's legal team, of course, everybody says of the complainant that he was powerfully compelling in the story he told.
Okay.
But the High Court's version. Let's take it from there. Yes. Sorry.
Okay. So the jury were convinced beyond reasonable doubt that George Pell was guilty of these charges. He of course appealed. He's always maintained his innocence, and this went to the Court of Criminal Appeal, where 2-1, they dismissed the appeal. So you had Chief Justice Ferguson and Justice Maxwell, President of the Court of Appeal. They again, I guess, like the jury, preferred the evidence of the complainant over this collective 23 witnesses who either said nothing happened or spoke to the routines and the processes and their recollections of the events. Okay, so it went to George Pell's defence team took this to the High Court. Okay, so what was the fundamental question that the High Court was asked to decide in this appeal? Justice Justin Hannabury, QC.
The fundamental question was they went up there on two grounds. First, they really needed to determine whether the Court of Appeal had erred in determining that the jury were not acting unreasonably, in that they could have reached a conclusion beyond reasonable doubt based on the evidence that was before them. There was also a complaint that the Court of Appeal had essentially erred in a sense, reversing the onus of proof, was the way the argument was put in the Court of Appeal, by essentially reasoning that the complainant was compelling and that it was open based on the other evidence, the other 23 witnesses, for there to have been an opportunity for the events to have occurred as the complainant described them. So they were the two real complaints. But essentially, it was a case that was one that required the Court of Appeal to engage in a detailed forensic analysis of the evidence, albeit from a starting point where they were accepting that the complainant was somebody whose credibility was accepted by the jury.
So in some ways, the question was, how do you weigh up the evidence of this complainant on the one hand and these other 23 witnesses on the other? And I think the criticism of the Court of Appeal by the defence was that the majority were in effect reversing the onus of proof. Instead of requiring the prosecution to eliminate all reasonable doubt, the court was requiring Pell to prove the offending was impossible. And our system is all about proof beyond reasonable doubt, and the onus of proof is on the prosecution. Justin Hanbury.
Thank you. The allegation was that they didn't, whilst with their words, they were constantly acknowledging that the burden of proof was with the prosecution, and this is in the Court of Appeal I'm talking about. The High Court didn't suggest that the Court of Appeal, by their direct words, said they weren't observing that the prosecution had the burden of proof, but they were saying by their method of reasoning in determining that question, they had, in effect, inversed that burden of proof. And they also seemed to be saying that the concept that if it was in some way open based on the 23 witnesses, that the belief in the credibility of the complainant could sustain a guilty verdict. Ultimately, the High Court decided that, in effect, that alibi evidence could not be overcome, no matter how powerful the evidence of the complainant was.
So, Professor Jeremy Gans, the jury acting rationally and on the whole of the evidence ought to have entertained a doubt about Pell's guilt with respect to each of the offences for which he was convicted. That's essentially what the High Court was saying when it was about comparing the two lots of evidence.
That's right. And when the High Court said that, they weren't doing anything new. That's been the test in Australian law for unsafe verdicts for over 25 years now. The High Court made that ruling in 1994, yes, in M's case, another child sexual abuse case. In that case, they split 4-3 on whether the verdict was safe or not, but it's the test, the same test that the High Court applied today. In fact, the High Court also applied the words of Justice Dean, who dissented in the Lindy Chamberlain case, and specifically found that the issue in this case was that there was a significant possibility that Pell was innocent.
Mm. Okay, so David Marr, there was this evidence from these 23 opportunity witnesses, which was inconsistent with the complainant's account. And look, let's just go through it. It described the applicant's practice of George Pell's practice of greeting congregants on or near the cathedral steps after Sunday Mass. Basically, you walk down, you know, the choir and the priests kind of walk down to the front of the church.
Thundering organ, choir in full voice.
Yep.
The Archbishop behind this vast cavalcade of gorgeously dressed children and, you know, priests and things, emerges at the west door. Now Pell had just taken over as Archbishop of Melbourne. Hitherto, Archbishop Little had a rather standoffish relationship, it seems, with his congregations. But Pell, the new man, and this was one of the first masses that he had celebrated in St. Patrick's Cathedral since becoming Archbishop, Pell, the new man, had a new practice, which was to stand on the steps of the west door. The choir and everybody goes away, and, you know, but he stands there with Monsignor Charles Portelli, his master of ceremonies, perhaps a few others, and he chats to the worshippers. Now, if he had stood there, a lot of this evidence is about how long he might have stood there. You know, if it was 10 minutes, then perhaps the crime was still possible. If it was half an hour, the crime was impossible. So there's an enormous amount of cross-examination at the trial about how long he might have stood there, whether the practice had begun before Christmas of 1996 or only after Christmas of 1996, and then whether indeed the practice attested to by Charles Portelli, the Master of Ceremonies, that he never left Pell's side when Pell was wearing his robes, was in fact, you know, a practice that was never, ever varied. But you see...
And there was also the conversation about the continuous traffic in and out of the sacristy for 10, 15 minutes after the conclusion of the procession.
Yes, because as Justin was saying, there are three issues here where the High Court said, you know, these really have to raise doubts. One is Pell on the West steps. One is him being always accompanied. And the third is that he was in a busy room. Now, you can't understand what the High Court has done today unless you understand the court believed the church witnesses absolutely in toto. There's no doubt expressed by the High Court whatever that they might have been over-egging the pudding or that they might have been, you know.
Okay, but that goes to the way the prosecution strategy. And Justin Hanbury, can you come in here and tell us about what that strategy was in relation to these witnesses? These were indeed prosecution witnesses. I think that's kind of lost in the mist here.
But that's just a formality, Damien, that they're prosecution witnesses. Yeah. And I just want to finish the sentence I was making, which is that they were not, that the High Court absolutely believed the church witness or the witnesses of church connected people because they were not contested strongly by the prosecution.
Okay, why was that the case? Let's talk about that. Justin Hanbury, QC.
Well, can I say first, formality or not, we have to acknowledge that the prosecutors fulfilled their duty to the court by calling witnesses whose evidence did not necessarily help the prosecution case. And I think that says something about our system in itself.
Yes.
That said, the question for the prosecution was that having these witnesses who it would seem to have been conceded even before the trial, certainly in relation to a couple like Portelli, that if their evidence stood effectively unchallenged, that created a big problem for the prosecution case in that it created a situation where the opportunity to commit these offences was either incredibly narrow or non-existent. And before the trial, acknowledging this forensic reality, the prosecution asked for leave to cross-examine the witnesses, which you normally would not be able to do with your own witness. One of the things that came out in the High Court was essentially, if not a criticism of the prosecution, an observation that regardless of that leave to cross-examination, to cross-examine being sought and granted by the trial judge, ultimately the evidence of people like Portelli more or less stayed the same from the time they first gave their evidence to the finish. It wasn't the case where they were effectively challenged and their evidence changed. So essentially that was the problem the High Court confronted for the prosecution, that the evidence from people like Portelli, even after they've been cross-examined or leave was granted to cross-examine, remained effectively unchallenged. And the question was, well, could a rational jury still convict whilst not ignoring that evidence or pretending it doesn't exist? Essentially what they're saying is a rational jury has to look at all the evidence. It can't just ignore the bits that don't suit the witness whose evidence they like very much. And ultimately, that's what they determined was the case here.
So, Professor Jeremy Gans, essentially the evidence of these 23 uncontested witnesses created what I think the defence described as compounding improbabilities. It was just it was there, it was uncontested, and it sat there, and the jury, the Court of Appeal, and the High Court had to look at it.
That's right. And the High Court said that the Court of Appeal went wrong in a couple of ways in how it looked at that evidence. For a start, they said the Court of Appeal looked at the complainant's testimony, amongst others, and spent a while debating and assessing how credible he was. And the court said that was a distraction. That's not their job. Their job is to go through the transcript and check whether all the evidence adds up. Secondly, they said that the Court of Appeal kept focusing on whether it was possible to fit all the evidence together. But that distracted the Court of Appeal from the majority from whether it was possible that they don't fit together to the point of reasonable doubt. And there's a third point about the all those 23 witnesses. Not only didn't the prosecution challenge the witnesses in the sense of saying, you're all just making this up, you've all got it totally wrong, you're over-egging what David just said. They didn't make that challenge. But as well, the Court of Appeal said, oh, but they're all, this was 23 years ago. They'd have trouble remembering. We can discount it for that reason. And the High Court said Victorian law doesn't allow the delay to be used in favour of the prosecution. The delay, the 23 years since this incident happened, that can hurt the defence and should be taken into account on the defence in the defence's favour, but you can't use that delay to get around problems for the prosecution. So the Court of Appeal made those three legal errors.
I think it's the forensic disadvantage faced by an accused when they're faced with allegations going back many, many years. Is that the what you're talking about there?
That's right. And it's in Victoria has what's called a Jury Directions Act, where the jury is told this is how you deal with issues like that. And that also binds the appeal judges as well.
Okay. So this is not a criticism of those witnesses. This is a criticism or an observation about the way the prosecution ran the case. Is that fair, Jeremy Gans?
It's certainly pointing out that the prosecution made choices in this case, which meant that it was stuck with some problems when you got to the High Court. The prosecution could have dealt with this mix of evidence in other ways. They could have said, oh, the complainant might have got some of the details wrong, and maybe this actually happened at a different occasion, at a different event even. That is actually quite a common thing to argue when people are remembering things from decades ago. They get key dates, details wrong. But the prosecution didn't argue that. They said he got his details right. They could have argued that all the other witnesses were just speaking nonsense or exaggeration or even lying, but they didn't argue that. And I think you can see why they wouldn't want to argue those two things. It makes it hard for them. So they went for another option, which was to say everyone's right, but Pell is still guilty. And clearly that worked for the jury. The majority of the Court of Appeal accepted it. But then that hit a wall in the High Court, and seven of them said that couldn't work in this case. That doesn't mean that this case could not have been won some other way, but the prosecution was stuck with the choices they made at trial.
Okay, but it doesn't mean necessarily that even if that kind of robust interrogation had taken place, that the result would have been any different. We just simply don't know.
We don't know, but you can see why the prosecution chose the path it did, because arguing that the complainant has got details wrong, or arguing that 23 witnesses are not necessarily lying, but have got significant mistakes in what they're saying, that's a pretty hard course for the prosecution. This was always a hard case for the prosecution.
Yeah, it's about not alienating a jury, and you adopt a certain strategy.
That could be it. There's always a lot of guesswork about how jurors react to these things. And we do know there were two trials in this case, so they had a second opportunity to have a go at this.
But a hung jury in the first trial, I think. Yep.
They made a strategic choice, and they can't back away from it now. And in fact, in the High Court hearing, the High Court were quite critical of the Director of Public Prosecutions, Kerry Judd, for at times, they said, trying to get around these problems with different arguments to the arguments that were put at trial. They said, you can't do that. Too late.
Okay. You're listening to The Law Report on Radio National. Today we're analysing the High Court of Australia's decision in the George Pell case. And I'm joined by Justin Hanbury, QC, a Melbourne criminal barrister who often appears in sex assault and historical child abuse trials, David Maher, journalist with The Guardian, and Professor Jeremy Gans, criminal law expert at the University of Melbourne. Look, Justin Hanbury, QC, this case was in many ways very different from most child sex abuse cases, because normally the dates and times of the allegations are very unclear. This was a total opposite, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think there are two. One major similarity with almost all child sexual offence cases. The similarity is the case for the prosecution depended effectively entirely upon acceptance of the complainant's evidence. However, the differences here with what, if I might say, is normally encountered was firstly in relation to the specificity they were able to have about dates. In this case, even though the charges were actually laid between, it was said to be to have occurred between July 96 and early 1997, effectively the evidence revealed that these events must have occurred, or the first charge, first incident must have occurred on either the 15th or the 22nd of December of 1996 at one of those two masses. Now, that is a highly unusual circumstance in that what that enabled the evidence to show was effectively what went on those two specific dates, because not only were they linked to a date, they were linked to a very specific event, being these masses. So that's where these 23 witnesses came into it. It's very rare that you have a case where, for example, somebody complaining about something in their childhood can give you a very specific date on which it happened, and suddenly the whole case goes off into what's effectively a description in some detail about what's alleged to have occurred and not occurred in an event 24 years ago. The other big difference is that even as compared with other clergy cases, the evidence here seemed to be that Pell's contact with the complainant was really restricted to these two offending events, as it was alleged. It's not suggested here that there was an ongoing relationship, a build-up of a grooming-type relationship. And I don't say that to make any comment about the probability of these events or otherwise. I just simply say that it makes it a very different trial to what one might normally encounter for offences.
And we've only got a minute or so left.
I think it is very important that this be said. There was an impasse here. Pell has been released because of an impasse. The court did not declare the complainant dishonest. They did not declare him a fantasist. They did not say that his evidence had such discrepancies or inadequacies that it should be disbelieved on its own face. He remains somebody whose evidence convinced, but against them was other evidence that the court said raised doubts. There is an impasse here, and as a result of that impasse, Pell has properly been released.
He has properly been released because the prosecution did not make out its case beyond reasonable doubt. That's absolutely clear. Jeremy Gans, final 30 seconds from you, please.
Look, I agree with all that, but I think it's a time when Australia can have a bit of a discussion about the balance they want to strike between jurors on the one hand and appeal courts on the other, and about the role of the High Court in Australian criminal justice. And finally, there's a discussion to be had about whether the sort of problems that the High Court picked up in this case should have been picked up earlier by the police, by prosecutors, even by the media who attended the hearing.
That's all we have time for. Thank you for all of you for speaking to the Law Report. That was Professor Jeremy Gans, criminal law expert at the University of Melbourne. Also there, David Maher, a journalist with The Guardian, and also Justin Hanbury QC, Melbourne barrister who often appears in sex assault and child sex abuse trials. Now, if this conversation raised any issues or emotional distress for you, please contact Lifeline on 131114. That's the Law Report. A big thank you to producer Anita Barrow and to technical producer Selwyn Cousins. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.